Sasha is a Nomad hacker with a weak spot for LEDs and completely abstains from HDMI adapters these days. He wanted to share with us the experience of attempting to build delivery robots in the past 2.5 years in the Bay Area. And so, yeah, let's give him a big welcome.
Thank you, Mikhail.
So just show of hands, who here has built robots before? Well, it's quite a few people. What about autonomous robots? Anybody built autonomous robots? Huh. Still quite a few people. Well, today I'm going to be sharing with you the story of how not to build autonomous robots. Over the course of the past 2.5 years, together with my team, we built the world's largest robotic delivery infrastructure. We went from a concept sketch to a commercially viable service running in 3 cities. We've had lots of successes and 1 or 2 failures. So over the course of the next 45 minutes, I'm going to be sharing with you a couple of different stories. First of all, I'm going to briefly introduce myself. Then I'm going to share the story of how we built robots, the different prototypes we had, the different iterations that we tried. I'm going to jump on to manufacturing. We actually went to China and scaled up our manufacturing, our production line. So I'm going to share with you the story of how we did that. And finally, I'm going to talk about AI and all the magic that is artificial intelligence. So we'll be able to see how we were able to crack that puzzle. So without further ado, let's do the introduction. So this is me, right here. I like to build things. I built my first website when I was 11, and I built my first business when I was 13. It was an iPhone repair business that I was running out of my bedroom. I've been really, really passionate about building things, and over the course of many years, I built a couple different startups. One of them was a food delivery platform. We ended up running 3 different cities and doing hundreds of deliveries a day by the time I was 19. So I got to experience startups pretty early on. I've been really enjoying that time. After this food delivery startup failed, I went to some cryptocurrency startups and then went to work for big corporations. And that was actually very boring. That's why I adorned my office with some supplementary graphics. After a while, I got a little bit bored of this corporate life. It wasn't really for me. So I decided to get a one-way ticket to San Francisco. So I ended up in San Francisco, staying on a friend's couch, not really knowing anybody. And I was really fortunate to be introduced to an incredible group of people. And over the course of about 2.5 years, we started to take a concept, a sketch that we had, and we built up a robot. At first, it was something that barely even worked. But then we gradually got to something that worked a little bit better and better and better. After a while, we actually managed to build a whole fleet of robots. I think at the peak, we had 150 robots. So it was a really, really cool experience. And during that time, I got to meet the Lieutenant Governor of California, got to figure out how to do manufacturing in China, and most importantly, work with an incredible team, who I had a lot of fun with building these robots. So yeah, that's a little bit about me and what we were building. And maybe now we can jump into how not to build robots. So this is our very first robot. This is a really small prototype we built. It was basically a shopping basket on wheels. There's a RC car there below. There's a shopping basket, and there's Arduino Raspberry Pi. The thing barely worked, honestly. It was really, really hacky. And what ended up happening is that most of the time, we just dropped off the robot in front of the customer. It's like literally just like dropped it in front of their door just to see if they would like order food with robots. The answer was overwhelmingly yes, so we decided to spend some more time building out technology. There is a small, I don't know if you can see it here, yeah, there you go. There's like a small orange holder, that's actually a phone holder. So our very first prototype, it had a phone sitting on top of it doing a video call so that somebody can remotely control it from Colombia. So we really started off small, really humble, just to see if it would work. And that's something we do a lot of, just being really resourceful in terms of trying out things. After about a year of this, we moved on to something that looks a little bit more like this. So we started playing around with the shape. We started playing around with the design. We noticed that people responded really positively to faces and to like things that looked like people. So we actually built in a face. So we took this little animation that we built and we put it onto the robot. And this is actually really, really positive. We had a lot of good responses from the community, a lot of great feedback. And what we've seen is that people really love to have robots that are kind of friendly. There was another company that deployed robots that looked like vending machines or almost like tanks in San Francisco. And they got banned really, really quickly. So we decided that we would do our best to make sure our robots were as friendly as possible instead of threatening and scary. So that was a very important part of it. After another year, we ended up scaling up our production, and we went to China to manufacture robots. And here, this is what we ended up hearing. It's actually a really cool robot. We built it entirely from scratch. We've got our own chassis, our own cabin, our own compute module, vision system, just about everything. So it was a really cool experience. That was me. So yeah, that's a robot. This is the one we were rolling around the past 6 months. And we also had some failures in between, as you saw previously, this one. So we actually tried a couple of different concepts. So this was one of them. This was a Kiwi trike. We thought that maybe we can figure out how to have robots do part of the delivery and then trikes do another part of the delivery. We also tried to do restaurant robots. We had like robots that are sitting in the restaurant and bring food out from the counter to your doorstep. But what ended up happening is that it was actually pretty inefficient, and people would wait a really long time for their deliveries. So it was really important for us to like try a lot of different things. We tried this robot, the Kiwi trike, that did not quite work out as we expected. We tried a restaurant robot. We tried a box that would sit behind our robot. We tried a hub that would have like a bunch of different robots inside of it. So we really, really tried a lot. And with every iteration, we constantly tried new techniques. We constantly tried new manufacturing methods. We really tried just about everything to see if we can make it work. And what we ended up building is a platform that was really loved by people. We built a platform that students adored. It was our primary demographic. We were delivering to college campuses, and students really loved our products. We actually had people dress up as Halloween costumes. We had entire classes go for Halloween in the Kiwi Bot costumes. So that was really, really cool stuff. Had a lot of great support, a lot of trust from the community as well. And that's like coming back to the design, that aspect of having a friendly robot that meshes seamlessly within the fabric of a community is like super, super important. We've seen other robots around, and they were maybe not as friendly. Maybe they looked a little scary. Maybe they had something that was a bit off or maybe a little too industrial. But having like a friendly robot that could become a meme, that was something truly revolutionary, something that really changed the landscape. And as a matter of fact, like these Kiwi bots are the only robots that are deployed somewhere in the world where they coexist day to day with a community, with people. Like, you have some limited deployments of robots here and there, maybe you have a Roomba at home or something like that, but you don't have any large scale deployment where you have robots and people living in the same city all the time. So, of course, it took us a while to figure out what to do and how to do it. At first, one of our models was to have robots deliver the entire meal, like go from the restaurant all the way to the customer, and we would have a robot do that delivery. Turns out it was pretty inefficient. People would wait like 60 minutes, 90 minutes for their delivery. And we realized that maybe automating all that was not the most efficient approach. So what we instead did is a multi-model approach where we had people and robots. This is actually a really cool visualization that my team came up with. The blue lines are robots. So these are robots roaming around our Berkeley coverage area. And then the yellow lines are people. So how this would work is that people would go to restaurants, they'd pick up the food, and they take it to a cluster. So they take it to a cluster where you had a bunch of robots, they load it into the robot, and then the robot would actually do the last few hundred meters to your doorstep. And because we were able to do this, we were able to go and build a platform that handled hundreds of orders a day with very, very few people. I mean, labor costs are really high for delivery. You'd be paying somewhere between $5 and $13 to get a meal delivered in the US. And as a student, that's like super expensive. It's not something that you can afford to do every day. And also, there is a pretty big shortage of people who want to do this job in the first place. The churn is really high. People are leaving all the time because they don't like to like sit in a car all day and just deliver food. So that's why we have this parallel, like this multi-model approach where the people are like biking around, they're enjoying their time outside, and the robots are actually doing all the boring stuff, like the waiting. So the robot would go up to your doorstep and it would wait for you to put on your pants, your shoes, and to actually walk outside. So that way we were able to change the dynamic, we were able to change our efficiency from like one or two deliveries an hour, as you would have with like a traditional delivery service, to as much as 15 deliveries an hour per person. So it made the delivery far more affordable, and we were able to offer delivery at just $1 a delivery, which is a cost that changes completely the way people approach delivery. And in fact, if we look at our top 20% of users, they were ordering over 14 times a week. So they were very, very happy that they could get whatever they wanted very quickly. Of course, not everybody was super happy, so we did have some people that didn't fully appreciate the magic that is the KiwiBot. So we did have one person try to steal it, but they didn't get away with it. We found them pretty quickly, and they hid it in the trunk. Not a very smart move. We ended up finding it with GPS and also triangulating the Wi-Fi. So this guy decided to steal it because he doesn't like robots. I don't know why, but he was clearly very passionate about that topic. And he stole it, and now he's in jail. So yeah, don't steal robots. So maybe some conclusions from our robot part, like from building robots, from figuring out like what to do and what not to do. A really important thing that we do a lot in software, but maybe not as much in hardware, is iteration. Like we iterated through three major revisions and like lots of small revisions during a really small period of time. It was really interesting to see like that transition. Every single time we try something new, we try maybe for like 20 robots at a time, or like not our whole fleet. We just try for a small portion of our fleet. And that way we were able to iterate really quickly and see what sensors worked, what cameras worked, and just to see what we could do in order to grow the product. So it was very important to iterate. Communication. Communication is absolutely fundamental. And not only communication like inside the company or anything, but more importantly, the communication with your community. Because we weren't just building a product in isolation. We were building a product for people who live in a city, who have an established life, and we're kind of intruding into their life by bringing in a new product that takes their sidewalks. So communicating what we're doing, showing them what this is and what this robot does is super important. And actually, very early on, our designs had no text in it. They had like no information. It was just like a basket case on an RC car. And people were like really confused. The police were like, hey, what is this? So we had to add a lot of communication. We had to like put food delivery on the robots really clearly. We had to add a license plate with like a phone number that somebody could reach out to us. So communication is very, very, very important when it comes to robots. And also, scaling hardware is hard, super hard. I mean, it was crazy. When we first started, it was just Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, and that did not scale really well. Like, sure, we could have maybe 10 or 20 units at once, but then how do you handle updates? How do you handle, I don't know, just weird things that happen all the time? So it was really challenging to do this. We actually killed a bunch of SD cards. Didn't really know you could destroy SD cards, but you can. And we learned a lot of things about hardware, pushing it beyond its normal boundaries. So yeah, iteration, super important. Communication is key, like getting buy-in from your community. And scaling hardware is super, super hard. That's something we actually figured out how to solve by going into China. So how to do, or how not to do, manufacturing. So as every China story goes, I hopped on a plane and I ended up in China. And it's really interesting to see, because like you have this perception of China from the media, you have this idea of what it would look like, but the reality is it doesn't look anything like what you would expect. It was a completely different world. It was at the same time Blade Runner and like the most modern city in the world. And it was truly an awesome experience. I highly recommend anybody who has the opportunity to go in and explore the world. But of course, the culture is a little bit different. We were surprised to see some things happening there. It was a weird dichotomy between communism and consumerism. So it's kind of interesting to see that sometimes. But the reason why we came to China is for manufacturing. And there's no better place for that than Shenzhen. In Shenzhen, you have Huashongbei. It's this huge market. It's a market that spans several city blocks. And you can actually find anything and everything you want. We were able to get components super quickly, super easily. And you can spend days just walking through a single building finding different things. There were entire city blocks dedicated to like just LEDs or just connectors or just processors. It was absolutely crazy. You could really, really, really get lost inside of these mazes. And what was really incredible to see, and something I've never seen anywhere else in the world, is just how easy it is to get hardware, to get things, to get parts. It was super easy to just go in and get something, and you could get it at one piece, two piece, or 1,000 pieces, like instantly. And if you're anywhere else in the world, that's super hard to do. So just by this virtue, you're actually able to prototype things, you're able to build things incredibly fast. You're able to go in, you're able to commission a PCB and get all the parts almost instantly, which is not something you see anywhere else in the world. And also a lot of the manufacturers have their booths here, so these would be direct booths from the manufacturers. So you can say, go up to them, start talking to them, and ask like, hey, can you make this product this specific way? Can you do it how I want it? And they'll be like, sure, why not? And they'll do it for you. So it was really, really valuable to just learn from these people, from the vendors here, from the manufacturers, about like how to build things. And it was actually really surprising to see everything they had in stock. 2 years ago, we built an art installation here that covered a tunnel with LEDs. We covered one of the tunnels at 34C3 with LEDs. And we used this tiny, tiny chip. It was a $5 ESP8266 chip that basically was able to control all your LEDs. And over the course of 5 years up to that point, I spent a lot of time figuring out how to build it myself. I played with Raspberry Pis, I played with PCA controllers over serial, and like I finally managed to get a prototype to work, but it was super clunky, it was super expensive, and it wasn't very reliable. And then I go to China, and I find that it's available there in much better quality, much cheaper, and much faster. So it was a really, really interesting shift in perspective. It's something you can't appreciate when you're abroad. Even if you're browsing like eBay or AliExpress, it's kind of hard to appreciate just how much selection you have and how you can find just about any tool, anything you need to find. So it's really, really incredible. But these markets are cool, but what was even cooler are the factories. And during our course in China, we were able to visit a lot of factories. All these factories, they were super, super welcoming. They always loved having you over. They invited you to really, really luxurious dinners where you had way too much food. And it was a feast and celebration every time. Actually, relationships are super, super important in China. Like a lot of people in the West, like they have contracts and they say like, okay, this is the terms of the contracts. Well, in China, you do sort of have contracts, but they don't matter as much as relationships. Like when you have a relationship with your manufacturer, you have to like always like go to dinner with them, drink beer, smoke, go to KTV. Like it's a really involved relationship and you're only able to have good communication based on that relationship. Because if you don't have a relationship, they kind of forget about you. And we actually had a couple of instances where manufacturers ghosted us. Like they had a critical component and they just stopped answering our emails, they stopped answering our WeChat, they just completely ignored us. And for some pieces, they were completely irreplaceable. Like we could not just go out and find another factory to produce a specific part the way we want it. And the only way you can ensure that this doesn't happen is by really explicitly making sure that you have good communication, a good relationship with that manufacturer. So it's super, super important. This is one of the factories we worked with. It's really crazy. I mean, we went there and we were just absolutely blown away by the scale of everything and also blown away by how manual everything is. There's actually audio here. Yeah, there you go. Everything was super manual. People were just like there with minimal or no protective equipment whatsoever, just like building things that looked like they were made by robots or machines, but they were in reality just built by people just with their hands, which is super crazy to see. And there were a lot of Blade Runner-esque designs, really bizarre contraptions there in this factory. This is our fiberglass factory. The way we built our casing, was actually prototyping it first in carbon fiber, fiberglass, and then moving on to a mold in carbon fiber. And actually Scotty, he made a really cool video on YouTube. So if you search for Hockey Stick Factory on YouTube, you can see a huge video where my buddy Scotty actually goes with me to this factory to discover how they make this mold and how they make these carbon fiber things. It was actually really crazy to see. It was cheaper to make a carbon fiber mold than it was to make a plastic mold. So since the tolerances were a little bit different, since like the process was a little bit simpler, you were able to make a mold that was very, very strong and very indestructible without necessarily having to have all of that expense up front for like a plastic mold. So yeah, that was our fiberglass factory. Really exciting stuff, really crazy scale. These folks, like the first night we came there, we arrived at like 8 p.m. and there was 100 people in the factory just like working at 8 p.m. It's really crazy to see. This is another factory we worked with. So this was a metal factory. It was actually really, really, really interesting to see how they built all these things. And at one hand, you can build super complex things. You can build super complex designs. But on the other hand, we got surprised a couple of times by being unable to manufacture really simple designs. And it took us a while to get a grasp of like, oh, okay, so we can make really complex metal that's bent, but as soon as we add a weld to aluminum, you start to have a big, big problem. So we had to like change a lot of our designs. We had to really adapt to the way things were being made in China. And sometimes you could adapt yourself, but like at an insane cost. So it was better to adapt to the way things were being done there. So again, very, very interesting to see how things are done. No protective equipment. This is like a 2-ton press and his hands are millimeters away from it. So yeah, it's a different world out there. Very, very different. Another factory we visited was a PCB factory. So this one has a really interesting story. This factory is not in Shenzhen. It's just across the border from Shenzhen. The city actually passed a law a couple years ago that has very, very strict environmental policies. So you're no longer able to do PCB manufacturing inside the city anymore. So we actually had to drive for a couple of hours outside of the city. And over there, there was a huge plant. And this plant was kind of semi-automated, handmade, where parts of the process were done by hand, as you see here, but then parts of the process were done with a machine. So they had this giant machine, which is basically like a black box. You can't really see inside of it, but you had a bunch of chemicals and it would just like take a PCB and just like move it forward through a chain. So it's really interesting to see. And this factory also had a really quick turnaround. They had a 3-hour turnaround if you paid a premium, and like standard was 24 hours. You could also ask them to do PCBA, so you can actually get them to assemble the PCB for you. And we ended up doing that for some of our PCBs. We'd like give them a bill of materials, and we'd give them our designs, and then they'd manufacture it. We actually got in a little bit of a situation with that, because we sent them some designs, we sent them some parts that we wanted to put in our PCB, and it turns out that one of these parts was unavailable, and they didn't tell that to us until it was almost Chinese New Year. So we had to scramble a little bit to find another solution. It was very interesting to see how you would deal with these factories. There were some even cooler factories. I think the coolest factory I visited was a battery factory where they made lithium ion and lithium polymer batteries. And it was almost entirely automated. You had giant films of things going into a machine, and then you had all sorts of liquids and powders that was like combined together. It was super, super cool. They didn't allow us to film it, unfortunately. There were maybe only a dozen such factories in the world, so they're very protective about their technology. But the scale of how quickly they're manufacturing these batteries was just incredible. They were manufacturing them at a crazy, crazy scale. So all these factories are cool, but actually building things is even cooler. So we ended up partnering with a contract manufacturer. I was really fortunate to find one through my network. Otherwise, I would have been totally lost. A couple of days before I ended up going to China, I found a contract manufacturer that liked to work with startups, with like small-scale people. And we ended up working with them to build our first batch of 50 robots. It was really interesting to see how different our designs were to what they expected. So they expected things that were really ready. They were very explicit, very clearly specified. But we didn't have that. The difference between manufacturing in the US, for example, against China is that in the US, like, it's a super long process and the back and forth takes super long just to get an idea of what kind of files they need. Whereas in China, you're able to like sit down directly with the engineer, with like the person in charge, and you can figure out what they need and they can help you out instantly. Actually, just here, I just want to show you one thing. So this is my designer, Alejandro, and he was translating from English to Chinese with his phone, with like Google Translate. And it worked surprisingly well. Google Translate actually is not blocked in China for some reason. We were able to communicate almost all the time with that. Also, WeChat has like a built-in translate feature. So WeChat is like this universal app that everybody in China uses and has this built-in translation feature that can translate new text automatically. So it was really, really cool to see how that worked. One question that we get commonly asked is like, how do we find our manufacturers? How do we build these relationships? So about 20% of that was through Alibaba. So our fiberglass manufacturer, we quoted like 30 different manufacturers and we went with the cheapest one. Of course, it was far more expensive than we expected. And we ended up working with them. 20%, like for example, our chassis, it was built with companies that we already had a relationship with, so we were just able to continue working with them. And then 60% was through just references, so just through like the network, just sort of getting to know people and talking to them and saying like, oh, hey, who did you use for this or this, or like, how did you make these PCBs, or just getting a conversation going. So having that kind of network was really, really helpful in order to build these robots. So as you can actually see over here, our design, this is what we had when we came into China. When we left, we had our own compute module, like super sophisticated, but this was like a Raspberry Pi, a Pixhawk, and a voltage converter, like a DC to DC converter. That was pretty much it. As you can see, it's not very reliable. It would break a lot. So it took us quite a while to translate this into something that was manufacturable. So it was, thanks to the dedication of my incredible team that we were able to do that. And we kind of did not know what we were doing, so we ended up having all of our parts and all of the components ready just days before Chinese New Year. So we actually had to do all of the assembly ourselves. We didn't have any Chinese workers who could help us do it, so it was our team just assembling things in the factory maybe like 1 or 2 days before Chinese New Year. So that was very, very interesting. We kind of hacked, or tried to hack Chinese New Year. We assembled all of our robots literally days, if not hours, before Chinese New Year, and we shipped them out, and everything was great, except our robots got stuck in customs. We had a trademark on our box, and the customs agent, they opened the box, and they saw more trademarks on some parts. We had 3D printed parts, and they're like, no, this is not going to go through without the proper paperwork. So our robots got stuck for 3 weeks in China, which was really fun, a little problematic. So yeah, those kind of things happen. You have to be ready for it. After we received our robots in California, we had to spend another like maybe 1 or 2 months refinishing them, redoing some parts, tweaking them, flashing them. So it was still a lot of work to get them to work. The pieces we shipped out of China was maybe just like a case with most of the electronics in, but not all of it. So we still had to do a lot of tweaking over back home. And of course, all this wouldn't have been possible without an incredible team. So I was really fortunate to be with some really, really passionate people, some people who would work 4 months in a row continuously without virtually taking any breaks. We had plenty of opportunities to go and take like the high-speed rail, or go to Shanghai or even Tokyo, but we all stayed in Shenzhen and spent a lot of time together building these robots. So it was a really, really arduous journey. So maybe some conclusions for scaling manufacturing, some of the failures we've had in relationships. I mean, relationships are super important. They're like super, super important in China, far more important than contracts. If you're able to have a good line of communication with your manufacturer, that really, really helps out. Because if you don't, things can go bad. We've had manufacturers that ghosted us. We have manufacturers that completely ignored us. Or manufacturers that just like replaced components because they just felt like it. So relationships, super important. Don't hack Chinese New Year. We tried it, doesn't work, it's a thing. China just shuts down for like 2 or 3 weeks. So it's really, really important to respect that. People buy tickets to go to their hometowns like months in advance, and they're not gonna move it for just like some pesky thing that you're building, especially if it's like some small scale thing. So yeah, don't try to hack Chinese New Year. Did not work out well for us. Also, do it with a team. While I was in China, I saw a couple of solo entrepreneurs try to build their own thing, and it was super, super hard, super stressful. Having a team is really great, especially if like a foreign place where you don't really know anybody. Having that team there together to support you is super, super important, especially since you can multitask, you can like split responsibilities and do something together. So it's a really, really important aspect. So that's how we manufactured and some of the failures we've had. Now, let's talk about how not to build AI. So as we all know, AI is magic, right? Just as blockchain and IoT in the cloud, it's absolutely magic, right? Well, the reality is it's not that magic. So we decided to have a very pragmatic approach to AI. We said, let's not do anything crazy. Let's just make something that works. So our very first iteration of our robot was this. This is like the control panel for a robot. It was super simple. We had a video call coming in from the robot on the left over there. It was like literally an iframe, super simple stuff. And on the right, we had a map. On the bottom, we had some controls so you can move the robot forwards, backwards. And it was very, very simple. It barely worked. On the robot, we had an Arduino and a Raspberry Pi all running like in Python, and then the server was Java, communicating over WebSockets. But this barely worked. So we decided, okay, what can we do? Maybe we can build an autonomous robot. Maybe we can build something that would work entirely by itself. We actually did that. So we built a robot that could go entirely by itself. It was fully autonomous. And it was actually really cool. The way we built it is we had a pretty beefy computer inside. We had an NVIDIA Jetson TX2. On that, we were running ROS. And inside of ROS, we were running TensorFlow and a couple of other technologies. We had YOLO for object detection and some other cool tech that I'm not entirely familiar with since I didn't write that code. But over here, what the robot did is it looked at objects, so it was detecting objects. It was also measuring the distance to the objects. And it also had an inference neural network, and you can see that on the top left of the screen here. Basically, based on trained data, it would know where not to drive into, and it would try to plot a path based on 12 different directions it could go into. So it had 12 directions, and it would go in the direction which had the highest probability of not colliding with somebody or something. And this worked okay. We were able to get like 99% autonomy. But the problem is, like, since we're doing a commercially viable delivery service that's like offering deliveries to regular people and it's not doing something in the lab, we really had to do something that worked all the time. And the challenge with this is we still needed to have people in the loop. We still had to have people who looked at the robot to make sure it would actually not crash. And what happens if you have something that's fully autonomous and people assume it works well? When it doesn't work well, instead of looking at the screen and being ready to take over, they're just looking at their phone and Instagram. So this approach wasn't the best one. And instead, we decided to use a supervision approach. So we spent a lot of time building this. So this is our supervisor's console. And it's actually a really, really cool platform. It's a platform that allows you to connect to a robot. And the robot streams to you video over WebRTC, over like the 4G network. And you're able to control it over WebSockets. So the way it would work is you would have a supervisor that just sets waypoints for the robot to follow. So the supervisor would just like click on the image, and he or she would tell the robot to like move, I don't know, 10 meters at a time. So typically they'd set waypoints every 5 to 10 seconds. It was a very interesting approach. We tried a couple of different approaches. We tried to do SLAM. That really did not work out for us. It took too much resources, and it didn't give us a significant gain. We tried other things as well. We tried traffic light detection. So we tried traffic light detection. There are some amazing models available online, some great GitHub repos. The problem is, yes, they do work on a very clean data set, but when you actually have data, when you actually have a real life scenario where you have like glare, you have rain, you have weird situations, you have homeless people, like it doesn't really translate that well in the real world. So we kind of struggled with that. Instead, we actually had a more middle ground approach. So we are able to detect traffic lights really well, but we're not able to detect the color really well, or the which kind of signal it's giving. So instead of what we do over here, this automatically zooms in to a traffic light, so it's very easy to see. This video actually that you're seeing is transmitted over very low frame rate, very low bit rate as well. Like I think we're doing 480p at 100 kilobits a second. So it's very, very low bit rate. And when the robot isn't moving, we actually make it go black and white and even lower frame rate so that it doesn't waste resources. So yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. Over here on the top left, we actually have our latencies. So we managed to build the infrastructure that allowed us to supervise these robots from Colombia for like 200 milliseconds, in less than 200 milliseconds. So it's like a blink of an eye. It was a really, really cool technology. It worked over 4G, and we did a lot to optimize that. We had also a map over here. So this map is really, really cool. A lot of people ask us, like, hey, did you do mapping? Did you map out your environment? Did you need to have something there before you came into a new place? And well, the answer is no. But what we do instead is we actually map out the network conditions. So we would map out the network conditions of a city, and we would say, okay, these areas, like over here, this is like high latency, we should avoid those areas because the robot could get stuck there. And it was actually very interesting to see the network conditions change continuously. Like you didn't have the same network conditions every day, all year. They'd actually change every few hours. So it was something that took us a while to figure out. So of course, the way this worked is we had two or three people supervising, two or three robots per supervisor in Colombia. And we had like just a bunch of people, typically students, who just be working part-time, and they were sitting in an office in Colombia doing this. Of course, the press found out about this, and they wrote a very small bit of text in this article saying like, oh, Kiwi hires Colombians and pays them $2 an hour. And people were really frustrated about that. We had a lot of interesting feedback about that. But what was interesting to see is that this technology actually helps people in Colombia. If you're there, it's a third world country, it's a developing country. You can get a job at a factory, you can get a job at like a textile shop, you can get a job maybe at McDonald's, but there aren't that many tech jobs per se. The biggest employer in the country is a phone support company. So like when you call in to support line, you get connected to Colombia sometimes, and that's the biggest employer in the country. So in order to get like a tech job, it's really, really hard. And giving people the ability to like go and supervise robots, it's something that helped them get something on their CV, it helped them step up, it helped them learn a little bit more about the technology and help them progress in terms of their careers. Our lead AI guy, he actually started off as a supervisor and he went up through the ranks and then he ended up leading the AI and robotics team. So it was really interesting and really inspiring to see how that transition happened. And we managed to get our technology to work so well that we can do this. So we were able to get it to work with up to 8 seconds latency, which meant that you can control it literally from anywhere in the world. So even from like an airplane above the Pacific Ocean. So it was a really, really interesting experience. And we really try to make it simple. So in conclusion, for AI, we realized that the best approach was to keep it simple. We tried a lot of different approaches. Like we tried the traffic light detection, we tried yellow pad detection, so I didn't mention that. So in Berkeley, you have these accessibility ramps and you have yellow pads so that blind people can actually like feel them and see them easier. So we built the algorithm to detect that and we thought that, okay, maybe if the robot is stuck in the middle of an intersection, it can automatically detect this yellow pad and like navigate to it. It's an approach that worked in theory and practice did not quite work. We tried segmentation. So that was an approach that worked okay, but some weird things broke it. So for example, any lamp posts or bicycle posts, they would like crash the robot because it didn't see it. So keeping it simple was the best approach, really not going too crazy. And the approach we ended up going in the end was to have it more of like a driver assist type, like a parallel approach, parallel autonomy approach, where our robots would help people the same way that cars would help people stay in lanes or have cruise control or like with parking assistance. That's kind of the approach we're having. I think long term, it is going to be possible to build a robot that's more autonomous. There are companies like Starship that have some interesting ideas about how to solve that. But I don't think it's quite something that could be scaled to every city just yet. Another really important thing is the lab does not equal the real world. So there were many, many great examples of fantastic research papers from some great groups. And they were great with very polished, very clean data sets, but they did not work when you deployed them on 100 robots that were all different, that all had slightly different camera calibrations, that all had slightly different hardware, that all had slightly different chassis. So it did not really translate as well. So these algorithms, these lab best case scenarios really need to be modified a little bit. What else? One thing, maybe jumping back to the keep it simple, we decided to put in a very simple safety mechanism. So the robot actually brakes if it sees something within 50 centimeters in front of it. So it's kind of like a last measure precaution. As you saw before, there's the video, like you can supervise the robot from anywhere in the world with a lot of latency. But having this 50 centimeter like hard brake actually saves us in case the robot loses connectivity or the supervisor is no longer able to supervise the robot. So it's always braking 50 centimeters away from any like collision with like a baby or a car or whatever. So the approach we really thought about is like, how can we expand human potential? There's a lot of talk about like AI taking jobs or AI like replacing people's roles, but we sort of kind of try to do that and it didn't work. Like we try to build robots that were fully autonomous that went from the restaurant to your door and that didn't work. People were waiting a really long time. These robots required an insane amount of maintenance. So we ended up going for an approach that was far more parallel autonomy where these robots were like helping people to do more. Same way the supervisors are getting these assistive technologies where they're able to just like set a waypoint to do the path planning and the robot does the motion planning on board. We also had the couriers who would just load food into the robots instead of the robots picking up food from the restaurant directly. So really expanding human potential, I think that's where it's at. And over the course of the past century, we've seen a lot of examples of this. Like we've seen operators of elevators. Like before, elevators had operators who would make it go up or down. And now they're fully automated. We had switchboard operators who would like connect phone calls. Now we can make a phone call to anywhere in the world instantly for free. So we're seeing this like transformation of work and transformation of the way things are done. And I think this is just the start. The way I see these robots is really meshing into the fabric of our societies and solving physical transportation. Like, sure, you can move bits from anywhere to anywhere in the world, but can you move atoms? It's really expensive to do that. It's really hard to do that. That's where I see robots expanding human potential. So, conclusions. What we did was really cool, and I think it was a cool experience. One thing that we realized is that tech isn't the hardest part, right? We like spent a lot of time figuring how to build something, but figuring what to build is sometimes very important as well. And I don't think we spent enough time asking ourselves that question. We kind of went in all sorts of directions. We didn't focus as much on making the best product possible. We kind of tried things that were really weird and not well thought out. So like having that more long-term thinking, like thinking what should we build is very important. Because like how you can just like look up a tutorial on Google and figuring out how to build a robot. It's not the end of the world. One really important thing for us was interaction. So interacting with people, figuring out how to make the door open when you actually received your food, super hard. That's super, super challenging to do. We're actually the only robot that opens the door for you. Other companies like Starship, for example, they have a button that unlocks a solenoid. So it's like the experience is not quite there. You have to bend it down and you have to figure out if the door actually opens. So we spent a lot of time, a lot of effort in order to optimize that experience to make it as smooth as possible for people. Also, one thing we didn't figure out is financing. I'll come back to that in a second. That was really, really hard to do as well. So like tech, you know, not the hardest. Financing, figuring out like how to manage cash flow, super important. But I think the most important thing is to work with a great team. If you're going to be spending a lot of time with people who you eat, live, and breathe with, it's really important to choose a team that you really connect with and that share the same passion as you do. Because you could be miserable making an amazing amount of money, but if you're with a really crappy team with a high turnover, it's really boring. I was really fortunate to work with one of the best teams in the world, and over the course of the past 2.5 years, we managed to do quite a lot. And just last month, we actually got an article in the New York Times. So that was a really big accomplishment for our team, and we got to share it with our families. My mom was really proud. So a lot of great traction and a lot of great coverage. But unfortunately, we actually ran out of money. So we kind of ran out of money last month, and we are no longer delivering things. So I decided to leave and start my own thing. Instead of doing robots, I decided to do data. So now I'm actually focusing more on building a tool that helps you tell stories with data. So this is Glint. This is a data storytelling tool. You're able to drag in some files, and it tells you the story of your data without you having to write any code. So my hope for this is to allow anybody in the world without any knowledge about how to wrangle data, how to clean data, how to analyze data, to be able to tell stories with their data directly from their computers. I'm imagining a tool where you can say, oh, in December there were XX visitors to Congress, or last summer we had XX sales, and it automatically fill that for you. That's kind of what I'm thinking about. If you want to join the effort, there's GitHub. I'm more than happy to have any contributors. And if you have any questions or comments, more than happy to answer on Twitter or here in person. Thank you.
So as usual, feel free to line up in front of the microphones or write your question to the signal angel over there that Theresia has one. It's all the way down. Go ahead.
Okay, here's a user of your service who apparently got an email from you that announced some changes So he's wondering what's up, what you're going to, what you're planning to do there, whether you're continuing your service or closing shop.
Yeah, it's unclear. We ran out of funds, so I think the CEO is still trying to figure out what to do with that. I wish him the best of luck, but I ended up leaving with a lot of other people. So we had like 50 people in November, now we have like 10 people left in the company. So it's very ambiguous what's happening, but yeah, I left.
Microphone.
No, audio. Ah, okay, now it works. But I'm a little bit confused because you are presenting a 1970s concept of a manipulator. Because a robot is something that works by itself, a manipulator is somebody who has some joysticks and moves things. So it's nothing special. You just have an internet link for a manipulator. And in the 70s, there were cables. So what's the special thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the magic here is connecting everything together. Figuring out, first of all, how to build these robots, how to build a reliable connection, and how to build a platform that works. And as I mentioned, like the how, that's not that interesting. It's more of the what you build. Is that experience where you're able to order anything you want at any time and get it delivered in under 30 minutes, virtually for free.
So for example, evil people could just buy a remote control car, put a bomb in it, drive under a police car, and make boom. It's the same use case. You deliver something.
There is another question there.
Yeah.
Hello. You talked about iterating quickly and rapidly, and that's a very good model for conceptual stage and software. Were you in the stage where you were releasing your hardware with your iterations? Because usually a big stack of certification has to come in between.
Sorry, I'm not entirely sure. Are you asking if we got certified at every single release?
I suppose, yeah, what level of like recertification? Was it totally released so you had to meet like regulations for each iteration, all that?
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't really get certified because we're not building a hardware product for consumers, so we're not selling it to anybody, we're operating it ourselves, so we don't fit under the same kind of requirements. However, we did have to have some permits, and part of the conditions of these permits was that we had to meet some expectations, but they're very, very basic, and they weren't rigid like an FCC or a CE certification, for example.
That was the question, yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Another question from the internet. Why did you develop different applications for Android and iOS?
For the consumer application?
I haven't got any more details.
We just did. I mean, we had at first an iOS application. I mean, 80% of our customers were using iOS, so we really spent a lot of effort like polishing that iOS experience, making sure that worked. And at one point, our Android app was working super badly, so we decided to kill it, and everybody was really, really pissed off, like extremely pissed off. So we actually reintroduced it, and we started catching up with features to the iOS version. Internally, all of our apps are built in React and React Native, so we had like a common framework for all of our internal apps, but we didn't have that experience. We were expecting the quality of the experience that we were expecting from a consumer app using React. So that's why we had two different code bases.
Yeah, all on the right.
Is this on? Have you tried different methods regarding perception, for example, LiDAR, radar, and what are your conclusions from that?
Yeah, we tried LiDAR. We tried a cheap LiDAR. We didn't try like a really high-end LiDAR. So the challenge with having like point clouds is that you have to compute, you have to spend a lot of time computing. We were using a relatively low power device and it was running from batteries. So we didn't have the luxury of having like 10 GPUs in the trunk of a car, for example. So that was one approach, one question. Another question is how much does it cost? So LiDARs, they can cost $10,000, $100,000. Our bill of materials was around $2,500. The last version was around $3,500. So all of our sensors were very minimal. In terms of what sensors we tried a lot of different sensors. We tried ultrasonic sensors. We tried near field infrared sensors. We tried other sensors. Yeah, we tried a lot of different sensors. We ended up just going with cameras. So we have cameras. We have six cameras on board. All of them are like full HD. We stitch them into an image on our compute module. And then the supervisor decides which portion of the image they want streamed so they can like manipulate with their keyboard to see which portion of the image is streamed. So we don't stream the whole image, we just stream part of it. A really important part for us was to make something that's viable, that can be used commercially. So I'm sure LiDAR is really cool, but I'm not seeing any commercial deployments of LiDAR-based autonomous vehicles or robots yet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've tried out many different concepts how to do it, and you saw that your company ran out of money. Do you still believe in the business concept of robots delivering packages of food?
Who knows? I think it was a great learning experience. We learned a lot. We had a great team, and I think we'll see some concept of robots. Maybe not exactly what we were building. Maybe something a little bit different. But I think it's a little bit inevitable, especially with the rise of self-driving cars. Maybe we'll have cars delivering packages instead of robots. I'm not entirely sure what it would look like. I could tell you Amazon, they bought one of our competitors, Dispatch Labs, so they're making a big bet on this. There are two delivery companies in the US, Postmates and DoorDash, that are building products internally also for with delivery robots. And also companies like FedEx are also building delivery robots. And then we have companies like Starship, for example, which are building robots and doing B2B with companies all over the world. So yeah, I think we'll see some form of delivery robots. I don't know if it's going to be what we had or what somebody else is going to have.
Were there any safety certifications you had to satisfy in order to operate around people?
No. So... Well, the thing is, in the U.S., like, it's kind of just do whatever you want. It's very different from Germany. You can kind of just do things, and you can do them until you get in trouble. So we kind of had that approach: don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. We ended up having to have a permit in the cities we operate in, but it was very simple. It was like, okay, you have to have lights, you have to have a phone number, and you cannot go in these areas. That was essentially all the authorization, all the permitting and certification that we had.
Yeah.
Wanted to ask, did you try other markets, like autonomous drive is very hard, even Waymo didn't manage it fully. So like perhaps elderly care, like you could use these robots in elderly care where you have a controlled environment where everything is the same. Did you search after other markets where it's less
intensive? Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, there is a lot of potential for markets like elderly care, for example, also for mail delivery, for applications inside of factories. We had a couple of different medical companies that reached out to us and like, hey, we want to move items, move packages inside of our facilities. So we did have a lot of interest. We try to keep a focus on the consumer space, like really building a consumer experience that worked out before branching out into these more B2B approaches. But yeah, elderly care could have been one of them. I think one important thing about elderly care and services like Meals on Wheels, for example, is that human contact. So I think people who are maybe not seeing as much of their family, of their relatives, they really cherish that connection they get from the people who deliver them food. So I think it's a multifaceted approach they have to have. You have a couple of different considerations with these kind of services for the elderly, for example.
Thank you.
What kind of personality do Chinese entrepreneurs have?
I think, well, as I mentioned, like, it's really important to have relationships. So they were very interesting. They were very deeply in belief of their government. They had nothing bad to say about it. They believed that it would bring them everything the best possible, even though they still try to access Facebook and Twitter with VPNs. So they were very, very loyal to their government. They were very, very diligent. If they committed to something, they would usually deliver on that. They really wanted to make sure you had a good experience. And also what we saw, for example, with building up these relationships, like the first few times we talked, they would try everything to impress us. So we got taken to these ridiculously expensive restaurants to make sure that we were welcomed well and make sure everything was right. Actually, I had an interesting episode earlier this year. I was going to go to Burning Man, and then all of a sudden, one of my colleagues had an argument with my manufacturer about whether Hong Kong is another country or not. And I ended up having to go to China to deal with our manufacturer instead of going to Burning Man to make sure we're aligned in terms of our beliefs. So sometimes it's really delicate. You cannot like talk too much about the government there. You can't talk too much about politics. It's best to just stick to business and focus on building a product.
I guess that was it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.